History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've figured out is really they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then invest a little time and patiently listen to what unfolds from there. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. In addition to all the veterans we've met on Hometown Heroes over the years, we've also introduced you at times to people who are actively attempting to showcase the stories of veterans. And in some cases, those people are veterans themselves. We're going to meet someone just like that today, and he would love to have you meet him and other veterans in person on February 25th for the 5th annual Unsung Heroes Black History Month Luncheon in Fresno, California. Ron Vance served in the Navy during the Vietnam War and in the Army 30 years later in Iraq. And in the last decade, he's gotten involved with something I hope you're going to take some time to explore at hometownheroesradio.com. It's called the Unsung Heroes Living History Project.
The Unsung Heroes Living History Project is a baby of Lisa Daniels. She interviewed me at the Boys and Girls Club in West Fresno in September of 2014. She asked me if she could interview me, and I said, I have nothing to say. She said, but you're wearing a Vietnam veteran cap. And then I hear laughter. And I go, what are you laughing at? 20 minutes had went by, and I was still talking about my adventures of being away from West Fresno as a 19-year-old kid. And here we are at 2023. I have established at the Maxey Park Center here in West Fresno over 120 photographs of veterans who came out of my neighborhood, out of West Fresno, who do not get recognized, okay? You always see superheroes and people, you know, that's off the scale of doing stuff in the military, but you never hear about the people who come out of my neighborhood, West Fresno. This is what my Unsung Heroes program is about. It's recognizing the veterans who don't have someone to see who they are or what they've been doing in the military.
And for people who aren't from this area, West Fresno, historically, and there are some developments we can go back through to explain why it was this way, but West Fresno, historically, has been an African-American neighborhood. So for Black History Month, it's an opportunity to draw more attention to this. And what you're saying is there are some stories out there that haven't been told, and you're trying to tell them. Is that what I'm getting?
Exactly. There's a Tuskegee Airman, one of the first Tuskegee Airmen, grew up right in Fowler, right down 7 miles down the road, okay, and he had a connection to West Fresno, Ace Lawson, and he went to Fresno State, okay, and people don't even know that, okay? But he's, you know, had a connection to West Fresno. There's so many athletes that came out of West Fresno, okay? Charles Young, Randy Williams, Maxey Parks, Bruce Bowen, you know, entertainers, you know. Jackie White was the second female to play basketball at the Harlem Globetrotters. Okay, all these people have a connection to West Fresno. But do you know who I am? I'm that veteran that nobody even talks about. You don't see me on television, and I am that connection to West Fresno. Therefore, that's why I have the photographs that I have with a little caption in them about the veterans that have a connection to West Fresno. The men and women, okay?
And I want to hear some of your story, because even though you didn't think you had a story before, now you know you do. And it sounds like you've learned a lot about some of these other stories. You just told us about Ace Lawson, who had actually played football at Fresno State, was one of the first African-American football players there, then became a Tuskegee Airman, actually had an aerial victory, had a kill as a fighter pilot during World War II. And yeah, most of the guys who play football there now have no idea who he was. And what are some of the other examples of the veterans who you have photos and captions of here where their experience or their story or just a little snapshot made an impression on you?
I was at the center here one day, Maxey Parks Community Center, and my sister, who's the director over here, Yolanda Randalls, she asked me if I would go talk to this guy on the corner. He's just sitting, drink coffee. And they were kind of afraid to talk to him. You know, it doesn't bother me. And I went over and approached the gentleman, and he immediately cursed me out. Like, oh, okay, no problem. I'll come back in a couple of days, all right? Every Tuesday and Thursday, I'm over here. And I came over again, you know, Thursday, and he immediately cursed me out again. There would be no third time, you know, be getting cursed out. But anyway, I came over here, and I had my Vietnam veteran cap. Come to find out, this guy's name was Hiram Cruz, homeless person. And I came with my Vietnam veteran cap on. He tried to stand up and salute me. And I said, don't do that. You know, I came back a week later. He's sitting over there in the corner. He's waiting for me. There's two cups of coffee, okay? And he says, I want to tell you my story. Okay, now I'm dumbfounded. Okay, this is a homeless guy here. What kind of story did you got? But anyway, I says, okay, Mr. Cruz, but I have to have permission in writing before I, you know, do anything. And I'm watching this gentleman write, like, this guy has perfect handwriting. Most of the time when you see a doctor sign something, you say, who put that chicken's foot down there and put that, right? I mean, you can actually read his writing. And he, you know, wrote his name out and stuff like that. And I'm going like, wow. And I said, okay, you know. And he went on to tell me a story about, you know, what he did in Vietnam. You know, he said him and his squad, he walked over 200 miles a night in North Vietnam. And he was in the Marines. He was a Marine. He was in there for like 12 years. And Mr. Cruz, as we were talking, he started to cry. I'm like, oh, man, what did I do? Strike a nerve? I said, we can stop. You can talk another day. You know, and I didn't see him for a couple of weeks. And he came back and he still had them two cups of coffee again waiting for me. And I said, Mr. Cruz, you okay? And he said, yeah, let's go outside. He told me we watched planes drop napalm on soldiers, and that blew his mind. You know, he got out of the Marines, I think, in 1972. He was in there for like 1961 to 72. A total of about 12 years, he told me. But anyway, from like 1973 on up until he passed away in 2016, the man lived on the streets. He never recovered from seeing that stuff. And that's what happens to a lot of veterans. You know, the people talk about PTSD, and it's like, you actually have to be in that situation to see that stuff. You know, you will see a dog or a cat run over in the street, okay? That will last with you, like, oh, maybe a day or an hour. But to see somebody, you know, screaming and burning and stuff like that, that doesn't go away. It never went away. But anyway, Mr. Cruz, he never became a civilian again. You know, get acclimated to being a civilian. For over 40 years, this man stayed on and off the street, and the streets finally caught up with him, and he passed away. You know, I hated to hear that because I like talking to him. You know, he sit right out there with a post out there, and we just sit and talk. And he tell me about the stuff he did in Vietnam. I'm like, wow. And I asked him one day, I said, Mr. Cruz, why do you have perfect handwriting? And he just had a little tiny smile on his face. And he told me, he says, if I get killed, the next guy has to be able to read my coordination notes. And I'm going like, wow. Because they were like, in Vietnam, they were mostly on their own, okay? And I'm going like, oh my gosh.
Everybody has a story, and you know that as well as anybody because of what happens with the Unsung Heroes Living History Project. And before the COVID pandemic, you had a few years in of this annual luncheon here in West Fresno in honor of Black History Month in conjunction with Unsung Heroes. What's the whole idea behind this luncheon? And if people come on February 25th to be a part of it, what do you hope they get out of it?
My hope is that people will learn about their Uncle Joe, their Aunt Sally, old Uncle Ted's picture on the wall that was in a military uniform that nobody ever asked a question about. You go by that picture every single day when you go to your grandma's or grandpa's house. You never ask any questions, okay? And my idea is to, like, ask a question. Even if they say, I don't want to talk about it, ask a question. And believe me, it would bring back memories of when they were 19, 20 years old. There's so many stories that's not heard. And like I said before, there's no superstars here. There's no heroes. Just plain old soldiers like everybody else. They've done the same job as everybody else, and their stories are not heard.
I think it's important for every community to preserve stories like this, but specifically with West Fresno, why is it so important? What's the value of asking these questions, hearing these stories? What kind of difference do you hope it can make moving forward?
The stories that, you know, you saw Uncle Joe's picture on the wall, the importance is to get out them stories. I don't care if they pushed a broom or dishwasher or whatever in the military, because everybody who was in the military, they had a job to do. And if you don't know what Uncle Joe or Aunt Sally did, you'll never know. But you have to ask that question. My Uncle Roscoe, his picture was one of those pictures at my grandma's house that I was talking about. Every day I went to my grandma's house. He's standing by this army tank, right? One day I finally asked a question. I said, Uncle, where were you at? And he says, I was in Korea. Yeah, okay. But he said, my father died. I'm going like, okay. And then my uncle started crying, like, oh my gosh, what did I do? Anyway, he said, you know, he got a letter from my grandmother and said that his dad died, and can you come home? And my uncle took the letter to his white sergeant. His sergeant says, if you go home to your dad's funeral, you cannot come back to the army. And my uncle cried again. Then I cried. My uncle says, why are you crying, nephew? I figured it out. 65 years it went by. He never told anybody why he didn't come home to his dad's funeral. And he said, you know, make sure you tell the rest of the family, nephew. My uncle was one of 11 kids, and I think he was next to the last to pass away. He told me, you know, when I was doing the interview, he said, make sure you tell the rest of the family. Well, all his brothers and sisters gone. I understand what he was saying is like, tell my nieces and nephews. Okay, he never told anybody. He finished his time in Korea and wound up going back to Louisiana, wherever it was, when he finally wound up back here in Fresno. But it's just the idea. That story was within hell with him for 65 years. And you know, you can imagine how hurtful that was. No, you can't come back. It's, you know, black and white world back then.
Well, and along those lines, you know, we can watch movies, we can read books, you know, Red Tails captured the story of the Tuskegee Airmen more recently. That movie Devotion talked about fighter pilot during the Korean War and that racial tension then. But there's no substitute for hearing firsthand stories, especially if it's people you know. And that's what I hear you advocating, people talking to their family members, getting the stories. And for you, you served in the Vietnam era and since then, but I bet you've gained an understanding of those who came before you and some of the things that they had to deal with, especially those in a segregated military during World War II. Are there some examples of that that just really kind of captured your attention?
You know, I was actually one of those guys. I got spit on when I got home from San Francisco Airport in 1973. And this lady came up and spit on me and called me a baby killer. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, me and I turned around and looked at my buddy and going like, should I backhand this lady? He just shook his head and said no. You know, we still had on our, you know, Navy uniform. Hey, we're back. We're back in Nixon Island and we're home, okay? No, we were not home. We knew who our enemies were, okay? But to come home and think, okay, we're safe. It wasn't safe. Wow. But anyway, I had to grow up. I had to grow up in a hurry after that. Before Vietnam, I had to grow up. And after I came home, I had to grow up even faster. I was 22 years old when I came home. And, you know, most kids at age 22, you're still in college. You don't even know how to wash your own clothes, okay? But being in the military, it made everybody grow up right now. Nobody's going to tell you when it's time to get up or go eat or wash your clothes or anything else. You went and did it or it got thrown out. If you missed what time it was time to eat, you didn't get to eat. Mom and Dad's not going to call you 10 times. This is the time what meal hours are, okay? If you didn't show up, well, you just had to wait till the next meal. But a lot of that stuff I tried to put behind me. About 10, 12 years ago, my wife told me, she said that I had to wear my Vietnam veteran cap. And I refused to wear that cap for years and years, okay? People are starting to say, thank you now. And I think back on that age 22-year-old kid, I was still mad, but I'm an old man now, you know. It's like, I can't be getting mad, okay? It's like, it's too hard. But, you know, and one of the other things was, yes, I still have PTSD. I do not like fireworks. I don't like loud noises. Unless I can see it coming, it scares me to death. My heart races. And my wife would always tell me, she says, well, you know, the doctor says you have to watch this. And I'm like, I'm not watching fireworks. You know, I saw too much of that in Vietnam, way too much, you know. Every day, it's guns blasting. Loud noise, boom, boom, boom. It's like just nonstop.
I want to hear some of the stories behind that. So let's rewind and let's go back to the earliest times, because you're the oldest of nine kids growing up here in West Fresno. What was it like back then? What do you remember about those early days that may paint a contrast to what we know today?
Back in those days, back in the 50s and 60s in West Fresno, everybody knew everybody. If you got in trouble, your grandmother whipped your butt, and when your mom and dad got home, you got your butt whipped again, okay? There was no escape from that. And that back then, you know, they had the principal would paddle your butt. He'd call your grandma and say, hey, so-and-so did this. Like, he did what? So, you know, if you didn't... If you've done one thing wrong, you usually got your butt tore up three times, and you never did that again. But today, there's no consequences for, you know, for what kids do, you know. Because I do lectures every once in a while. At 8 a.m., I'm standing outside the door. Be quiet, Mr. Vance will be here in a minute. Be quiet, Mr. Vance will be here in a minute. Be quiet. Sometimes I would hear that three or four times, and, you know, my time would start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd say to myself, I got told that one time. One time. That was it. You know, if somebody got told, you know, to be quiet the second time, get out of the classroom. I guess, and today you can't do that. My sister-in-law was always saying, like, Ron, you need to be a teacher. Like, no, I can't be a teacher because I was raised the old school way, okay? 8 o'clock means you're there 10 minutes before 8. You don't show up at 8 o'clock. That's just not my DNA to do stuff at the last minute. You're there, ready to go, 10, 15 minutes. And when your time starts at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock or whatever, you're starting. But far as growing up in West Fresno, I wasn't hungry. I wasn't rich either. And to go to downtown Fresno, that was a treat. To go to the White's Theater on Saturday morning, that was a real treat. But now it's all changed. I, you know, change is good and it's bad. It's good that, you know, stuff gets to grow. And it's bad that there's no old school teaching in that, any of this stuff.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with Vietnam veteran Ron Vance of Fresno, California. He'd love to have you join him there February 25th for the annual Unsung Heroes Black History Month Luncheon. Find more information about that at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll explore some of Mr. Vance's military memories when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with a veteran doing everything he can to honor his fellow veterans, especially those who come from his neck of the woods. On February 25th in Fresno, California, he'll host the 5th annual Unsung Heroes Black History Month Luncheon. Ron Vance served our country in the Navy in the Vietnam War, then 30 years later deployed to Iraq with the Army. But let's go back to before all of that. You were going to school. You know, this is after World War II, after the Korean War, the armed forces have been integrated, the professional sports leagues have been integrated, the civil rights movement is taking shape. How did you see all that playing out in West Fresno?
Okay, you know, I can tell you, one of my high school teachers, my history teacher, he did like this. He says, you will be over in Vietnam within the next 2 years, junior or sophomore in high school. And, you know, we fill our seats laughing. What's this man crazy? You know, that's the stuff we see on TV. You know, we remember seeing that My Lai massacre and all that other stuff. Like, no, that's not going to happen to us. That guy died, that guy nuts. And here I am telling these stories over 50 years later. My high school teacher was absolutely right. I don't know if there was a program against people of color at the time, but he knew. Like I said, he says, you. He was talking about three black guys and one Hispanic kid. And guess what? It all happened. Then he, you know, I still remember he went on to say, like, all of you wind up in a factory job. Well, I don't want to do that. And I'm not going to work in a grain field either. But that was more or less, this is what you're going to get out of life. That's not the lesson I got at home from my mother, okay, and my grandmother. My mother told me, she says, and I'll never forget that. I was 12 years old. My mother said, don't nobody owe you nothing. If you don't go out and get it, you ain't getting it. And if you go to jail, don't call me. I'm almost 72 years old. I still remember them exact words, okay? Like I say, there's no old school lessons with the new generation now. New generation now, they want to start off making $100,000 a year instead of pushing a broom making, you know, 90 cents an hour when I started working. It's like, you know, I don't like this job. The world doesn't work like that. I hate to tell you, it just doesn't work like that.
Did you grow up with a sense of what previous generations had to deal with in terms of racial discrimination or access to things in this area?
I did. You know, when I was a youth, my grandmother told me about stuff like that. And she told me, this is a black and white world. And she told me when I was about 8 or 9 years old, she says, if anybody ever put their hands on you, make sure you kill them. Those were exact words. And I never forgot that. And when I was in the Navy, the white kid thought it would be funny to, you know, shove his finger up my ass. You know, I can't say that. But I did. I turned around and I grabbed him by his throat and I was trying to kill him. My grandmother was on her deathbed. Now, we're out to sea in Vietnam, okay? This is a true story. You know, and I looked up and my grandma says, put him down, son. And I said, no, Mom. And my best friend hit me in the side like 2 times. He goes like, Vance, what are you doing? You know, says, I'm going to kill this SOB. He says, put him down. And I never did hear him. And my grandmother said, put him down, son. He won't ever bother you again. After I put the kid down, my friend at the time, he says, you have to go apologize to that sailor. I says, you know what? Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I would look for the kid. And every time he would run from me, he was afraid of me. I'm not a bad guy, and I don't do stuff like that. But you know, I was 20 years old. You know, the way 210 pounds and not an ounce of fat on me. And I guess, you know, I look back on it now, I guess I was a pretty scary looking guy. But, you know, I could never see that. But like I said, my grandmother told me, she said, you know, if anybody ever put their hands on you, make sure you kill them. And I was going to kill him, too.
Well, you just said something that I think was really insightful and helpful for all of us to consider, that, you know, sometimes we don't see ourselves for who we are. And it's not possible for me to see through your eyes unless you share some of that perspective. And from my mind, maybe you have a different take. Isn't that what Black History Month is all about? It's not to say black instead of white or black versus Hispanic or anything like that. It's saying, hey, this is how we've experienced it. This is what we've dealt with. Let's tell these stories because all of us can benefit from having that perspective.
This guy, you know what you just said, Paul, you have to walk in my shoes, okay? And most people of Caucasian descent have never, ever walked in a black person's shoes, okay? This is what you get. This is what's left over. This is what you get. You don't get to start off with a brand new pair of shoes. You get to go to the secondhand store and get those leftover shoes or dress or pants or whatever. You know, and I would say this. You know, a lot of people, they have had, you know, new stuff. But as a black person growing up in West Fresno, when you got a new pair of shoes, which you earned, okay, being out in the great fields, or a new pair of pants, you earn that tooth. I can still remember when I was in the 10th grade and I wanted a new pair of Chuck Taylor Converse All-Stars, right? And my mom says, go out there and get them. I'm like, okay, Mom, give me the money. They're out in the great field. Go get them. You had to go out there in the great field to earn that to get a new pair of shoes. And I still remember those shoes. I think they were like $2.85. Okay, this is, we're talking a long time ago, okay? And I know a pair of the Jordans or whatever they cost is like $150 now. I just can't see that for a pair of sneakers, okay?
Well, those Chuck Taylors from the 60s are probably worth more than you paid for them now.
Exactly. But that was what everybody wore, is a pair of Chuck Taylor Converse All-Stars.
And let's go back to the 60s a little bit because, you know, I talk mostly to World War II vets and their lives were interrupted. There was a draft back then. My generation can't identify with this concept of a draft. We've never had to face that. In World War II, they did. In Korea, they did. And certainly in your era in Vietnam, they did. So help me understand who you were before you ended up in the service. What were some of the hopes and dreams and ambitions you had as a kid growing up? Like I said, the oldest of nine in your family.
When I was still in high school, professional baseball scouts wanted me to come out and try for the team. And I go like, yeah. You know, and I took my cards home to my mom, and mom says, you're going to college. That was half a dozen teams wanted me to come and try out. And I'm going like, okay, well, I'll go to college. I was not college material. I was not ready for college, okay? We went for a year, flunked out of school. And I think back on those times, I'm like, man, if I coulda, shoulda, woulda. But you know what? That's past tense. But went to college, went for a year and flunked out. And it's like the draft was still around. When I started college, the draft, I think, was in August of 69. And I had just turned 18. I was safe that year. The next year, August, come around, I think they had a draft again. My number was 3. And I'm going like, I don't want to do that. And my brother-in-law at the time, before he married my sister, his number was 300 and something, okay? He says, oh, I don't care. If they draft me, I'll go. They never bothered him. So, you know, I wound up going to Pasadena to live with my aunt, you know, try to get a job down there and go to school. And my mother called me one day. She says, there's a letter here. I said, Mom, don't even open it. I'm going to join the Navy so I don't have to go to Vietnam. Well, guess where I was at 3 months later? Downtown Saigon. This Army guy saying, your ship's out there and we'll get you to it. You know, you talk about a real culture shock. You know, growing up in West Fresno, everything that I knew in my life was within 1 mile, you know, other than we played, you know, sports against another high school. You know, Dos Palos was the furthest I'd ever been in my life, 50 miles away. And everything I knew in West Fresno was like 1 or 2 mile radius. But to go, you know, 8 or 9,000 miles away, it's like, what is this? This is stuff you see on TV. This is not for real. That stuff made you grow up in a hurry, and it made you appreciate everything that was in West Fresno. Okay, it wasn't much, but it was home. To go see some of those third world countries and people who have never seen a real third world country, okay? And I don't mean the kid with the swollen belly in Africa or South America or something. To go to see one of those third world countries, you'll appreciate everything you have in this country. And people don't. They do not.
And so for you, the letter comes to your house. You know they're drafting you into the Army unless you take matters into your own hands. And maybe it's obvious to you, it's second nature, but explain for the rest of us why that was how you felt about it. Why the Navy instead of the Army?
My cousin was in the Army. I had a couple of uncles who were in the Army, and they told me about living out, and you know, they got to put a tent out, and they're just out there. I'm going like, I don't want to do that. I am not going to do that, okay? I tried to get in the Air Force, and my AP scores, they weren't high enough. I'm going like, oh, man, you know what? I'm in trouble. I wanted to get in the Air Force because my dad was in there. I didn't even go look at the Marines or the Army. I said, no way I'm going to get in that, okay? I said, well, you know what? I'll get in the Navy and not go to Vietnam. That was a mistake.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but you mentioned your dad having served in the Air Force. Did he ever tell you much about that?
You know, that's, Paul, that's one of the reasons why I do Unsung Heroes. My dad told me one story. You know, he was at March Air Force Base down there, and he said they lived on the base, and they would come down here to visit my grandma. He never talked about it. He never really talked about it. And I'm going like, wow. You know, and again, like I say, that picture on the wall of old Uncle Jay, nobody ever asked any questions. I never asked any questions. Never asked any questions. And, you know, and I would ask my dad's sisters, I says, did any of you guys have a picture of my dad in a military uniform? They said, no, it you know, burned up in their house. But that was, you know, one of the things I wanted, hey, dad went in the military, you know. And when I went in, my dad was, how would I say, he was upset, but he wasn't upset. And when I told him, I said, you know, I'm going to go, he had a little crooked smile on his face. And, you know, he was kind of, because the Vietnam stuff was going on, okay. And he had been to Korea. He didn't want to see me go through that crap that they went through. You know, it's okay, but it's not okay. You're 19 years old. You're still a kid. And I'm thinking to myself, well, my friend's dad was 16. And my uncle was 16 when they went to Korea. He go, that was different. It wasn't different, okay? It's just that you see people, like your kids, you see them as always a little kid. You can't be going to military and fighting and stuff like that. That's for older people. Where you think the people are in the military. And the old guy's 32, okay? Everybody else is under 30, unless, you know, it's a commander or admiral or something. They're in their 40s, but everybody else is, they're in their 20s.
So what did you expect from the Navy? You really thought it was going to keep you out of Vietnam?
Yeah, until, you know what, when I got to my first ship, USS Oklahoma City, CLG 5, I'll never forget. We got to the enlisted barracks in Japan, Yokosuka, Japan, and the desk attendant, he says, your ship's down there. Down where? Look out that back door as we're carrying our backpacks. I'm like, oh, wow, the ship's down there. Anyway, we had, you know, come on board and, you know, permission to come aboard and all that good stuff. And quarterdeck enlisted guy, he says, you guys are going to be in 1st Division. I'm like, well, what's 1st Division? Needless to say, that's where the bombs are held, okay? And they put us to work right away, slamming bombs against the bulkhead. And I'm going like, oh, my gosh, what did I get into? Yeah, I don't want to do this. The gunner's mate, as they're slamming them bombs against the bulkhead, you can hear this ding, 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 ding. What is that? He said, that's just the pin coming off. Well, what does that mean? If one goes off, we're all dead. Like, oh, let me get out of this division. You know, it's serious. Like, I couldn't wait to get out of that. Yeah, I got out of the division and I wound up being a cook. The cooks have, they have the longest hours of anybody on board ship. Usually a normal working hour day is like 19 hours. And I got into that and I like that. I wound up being a cook for like over 20-some years. The stuff they teach you as being a cook, okay, you get to go through all phases as being a cook, okay? You learn how to bake. You learn how to be the watch captain. You learn how to order chow. You pick the people who's going to be on your watch. You know, it's rotated every 6 months. So you learn all aspects instead of just standing there being a guy that's frying hamburgers on the grill. Everybody has to learn everybody's job. And I thought that was great. That's, you know, one of the things that I learned in the Navy. I'll tell you, cooking breakfast was like one of the hardest, but one of the easiest things to do. There's 1,400 sailors and Marines on board ship, right? And you got 100 guys lined up every morning, and you have to cook 100 eggs at one time. And they're all screaming their name. Vance, this is Jones. I want over easy. Johnson, I want scrambled. You know what? And after a while, you remember their names. You remember that, okay? You learn how to move 1,400 people in a few minutes and like, less than an hour.
What were the pros and cons of living aboard ship?
Okay, and again, one of the pros, living on board ship. You know, it was long hours, but I got a shower every single day. If you're in the Army, you're out in the field, well, you might take one of them creek showers or whatever that was, okay? It's like, I'm not doing that. But on board ship, every day, it was a shower, you know, a hot meal every day, 4 hot meals every single day. There was none of that sea ration stuff. Usually on, like, the holidays, they were really good, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas like that. But they would have ethnic night on Sundays, you know, Beefeaters night. They would have, you know, African-American day for Sundays or something like that. And it would change, and it was really good. And I think the sailors, they really liked that, you know, because all of them would eat whatever ethnic night it was. Everybody would eat.
Were they all nice to you because you were cooking?
They didn't have no choice. I can tell you, another true story. When I was in the cook's mess, okay, think they had 27 chiefs in there. And this one chief, he didn't like me because I was black. Okay, I was an E3 and I had an E5 working for me. And this chief, he orders his breakfast one morning, you know, eggs over easy, bacon, toast, right? And I give it to my E5, was taking it back. And my E5 was my key P because he didn't know how to cook. Takes the order back in there to the chief. And the chief says, you know, he brought her back. His chief said, these eggs are not over easy. Like, what? Put them back on the grill. Cooked them a little bit more. Give them back to my E5. He took some back and he brought it right back. What? The chief said, these eggs are still not over easy. I'm going like, what? Third time. I took plate and all, threw it on the grill, okay? Everything that was in there, flattened them eggs and made them hard as a rock. Took that plate in there myself. And I go, chief, here's your eggs, and threw it all in the can. That's a true story. And the other chiefs just cracked up. They just laughed, okay? And I'm going like, oh, my gosh, what did I just do? And here comes my master chief, E9. He says, come with me. Like, oh, my gosh, I'm in trouble. He told me, he says, you cannot do that. But he said that SOB will never bother you again. That's the truth. You know what? He never did. They all knew who that guy was. He was, you know, I have to say he was from the deep south, but he was raised up with that, you're a black person, you're less than me. But, you know, he never bothered me again for the 2 more years I was on that ship. He never bothered me again.
How long were you aboard ship?
3 years.
What were some of the most challenging situations you had to deal with?
Well, let me see. I would say learning how to sleep when those 5- and 6-inch guns are going off day and night. They would rock the ship, and they would actually rock you right in your rack, too. You know, you try and sleep. And for years, I would jump in my sleep, and my first wife would say, what is the matter with you? You know, I'd be trying to sleep, and I'd jump in my sleep. And I'd go, like, I don't know. I didn't know that I had PTSD. I did not know. But that was one of those things that it took me a long time to get over. Just a long time, you know. And, you know, when we would go out to sea, they'd say, we're going to be taking on JP-5. We're going to be getting chow and pick up some sailors, you know. Those were the hardest days of being out to sea. Because when they're, you know, they're taking on JP-5, which is gasoline, they're just going around in a circle. We're not going anywhere. And, you know, and to take on supplies from another ship, they had to muster up 100-man working party. That's a lot. And you're just shoveling groceries down to the dry stores or to the freezer for like hours, for, you know, 5 or 6 hours. They took everybody who was like E3 and below, you're working. And that was one of the things that I'm going to hurry up and make E4 because forget this working stuff, okay? The watch captain that we had in the galley, Rivera, I'll never forget him. Never, ever forget this guy. We would go to another port. He would say, get the books out. You're going to study 2 hours before you leave this ship. We had to study 2 hours before lights out. Because when it came time to take the exam, he says, you guys are going to pass this. There was three of us. And when we got back to Japan, you know, the proctors, they were all walking around, and we took a test. We were all done about the same time. One guy got 100% on the test. And I got like in the 90s, high 90s. And my friend, he got in the high 90s too. And they go like, nobody gets scores like this. You know, everybody just, when the guys pass the test, it's just enough to make rank like 70 or something like that. Then the proctor says, you guys cheated, you know? And I'm serious. My watch captain, he says, where did you get that from? He says, nobody gets high scores like that. He says, I made my guys study. They know all of this stuff. They wanted to make us take that exam again. My watch captain on the LPO, he says, they're not taking this again. They're not doing this because these guys studied. And that's just what we did. We studied. We hated studying, okay? I mean, you know, we've been out to sea for 35 days and we're watching everybody else going on liberty. And we got to be in the books for 2 hours. Our LPO would ask us a question. He would ask us, you know, how many cups are in a gallon? Mm-hmm. If you don't answer, he's going to come back to that question and ask us again, okay? And you better know. And guess what? We learned every question every day there was to ask, you know, every possible question they were going to ask us. To do stuff like that, I don't think I can do that today. That's just too hard.
I was just going to ask you, how many cups are in a gallon?
16.
Of course, he'd never forget that. It's time for our final break. Don't forget to go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to link to the Unsung Heroes Living History Project and get the details on that Black History Month luncheon that our guest today, Ron Vance, will be hosting February 25th in Fresno, California. One of the people who's going to be there will be the man who saved Ron's life in Iraq almost 20 years ago. That story and his honor flight experience as well when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a heads up for you on an event a couple weeks away in Central California. Even if you're not in that area, I trust the story that Ron Vance has been telling today is adding to your perspective. He's going to be hosting the 5th annual Unsung Heroes Black History Month Luncheon in West Fresno, California on February 25th. It'll be showcasing the legacies of more than 100 veterans from that area. And a half century ago, Vance was a young sailor off the coast of Vietnam.
The ship I was on was USS Oklahoma City, CLG-5. We were 7th Fleet. We were the command ship, the West Pacific. We had Zumwalt was on our ship and a couple of the admirals, but that was our job. You know, we'd lead the pack, okay? And the ship I was on, it was slowest tomorrow coming around. To get away from, you know, MiGs that were shooting at us and stuff like that, we were just plain old target practice. Until we could turn around and get going, we're like that big diesel truck, okay? It's slow as heck trying to get on the freeway. But when it gets to going, but you got to get to going first, okay? You know, we would always be scared, like, oh my gosh, we'd hear bombs splashing in the water, he missed us again. Or they'd say, somebody on the risk, and one of the pilots shot down a MiG plane, you know, they were after us. Because they knew we were 7th Fleet, Gray Ghost, the Vietnam coast, okay? We'd go over there in North China Seas and launch bombs 12 miles away. They never saw them coming.
Well, and you're hitting on a lot of things I wanted to ask you about. And it's funny you mentioned the Oriskany and shooting down a MiG, because a pilot who shared his story on Hometown Heroes just got the Navy Cross a couple weeks ago, 70 years after in Korea he shot down 4 MiGs off of the Oriskany. But this is a couple decades later that you're talking about. When you mentioned having admirals on your ship, and Zumwalt, of course, is from this area down the road in Tulare.
Yeah. Matter of fact, Zumwalt still owed me $50. The guy used to love playing poker with enlisted guys. I'm serious.
All right, so let me come back to that in a second. That's great. But if you're going to have the commander of the fleet on your ship, you know you guys are probably a target the enemy would like to take out, right?
Yeah, we definitely were a target. When we would get too close to land, and Marines would be mounted up on the front of the ship. The Marines were always out there firing their weapons. They'd be firing a 50 caliber. And I can remember one incident, the Marines got on a bullhorn, and they told this junk that was coming out to halt. They would tell them, you know, 2 or 3 times in different languages and stuff to halt, and they'd open up on them, right? And we're just kind of sitting up on the deck just watching this stuff, okay? Because the Marines are, you know, they throw something in the water and just target practice. They told this one junk to stop one time. It didn't stop, and they opened up on it. Gasoline blows up one time. Bombs keep on boom, 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 boom. They were coming after us. What do you do? You're scared to death already, okay? These people were actually coming after us. Luckily, you know, the Marines we had on there, they would always take care of business.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, bombs splashing in the water and planes coming after and all that. Is there something that you look back on and you say, hey, that was my closest call? Or if that had gone a little differently, that might have been it for me?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I can remember the one time that we were being attacked. I had just got off being night baker. Just got off, okay? And I was just going to sleep at 5 o'clock in the morning. And the cooks were up there at their duty station because I had to wake up to oncoming watch. And I just lay down and went to sleep. And I thought I was in a bad dream. And the guy comes and taps on my bunk. Vance, get up. Vance, get up, we're general quarters. Like, what are you talking about? Get up, we're general quarters. And you couldn't hear a sound. As I'm getting up, I'm getting dressed, I have to go to my general quarters station. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is for real. We're goners. You can see all the guys in their gear, you know. They're going to war, you know. And I got to go, I don't know how many doors I had to go through. I think 4 or 5 doors, you know. And you have to latch them back down, you know, because I had to get back up to the galley to my GQ station. We were, I think, 2 or 3 decks down. And you had to go up to go to my GQ station just to to see all those guys, and it's dark. It's like 5:30 in the morning. That's when attacks happen, just when they can see you. Just enough daylight. That's when you always see them programs when they're attacking the shoreline. It's right at daybreak. I had to get up to my GQ station, and believe me, I was crying. I was scared to death. I'm like, this is it. And, you know, and then, you, like I said, you could hear bombs splashing in the water. They're missing us. Like, oh, my God, this is not happening. But it happened. And like I said, we were lucky. One of the carriers, they shot the plane down. When I have my program on Black History Month, hopefully my friend Henry Baskerville will come. He was a radioman, and he stood up on the radio deck, and he drew a picture of that plane coming in. I think he was just petrified to see that. I'm like, what are they doing attacking us? Yeah, that's what happened. They attacked us. And we were like, you know, like I said, that slow diesel truck, you're in the way, but you got to get going to get out of the way. Just barely got away. One of the other smaller ships got hit. You know, they did awesome sailors. And my wife at the time, back in Japan, they were scared to death because, you know, they said, well, Oklahoma City got hit. Another ship got hit, the Boss Hill or something else. When we finally got back to home port, that was a relief. Because you know how rumors start about that ship got hit, this ship got hit. And it's like, well, no. We barely made it. They didn't mention none of that.
There's so many stories about what didn't happen that are almost exactly. Sometimes more than what did. And you mentioned that other ship lost some sailors. I guess that's a question I need to ask you. Were there some people that you knew, either before the war, during the war? You mentioned guys you'd gone to high school with were KIA in Vietnam. Are there some people that died during that time that you've thought about over the years?
Yeah, my one friend, Ron Holly, we went to elementary school together and high school together, and he died over in Vietnam. I was in the Navy and he was in the Army, and I couldn't believe that story. You know, I saw one of my other friends that was in the Philippines. I just happened to run into him. You know, we went to high school together, and he says, yeah, Ron Holly got killed. And I'm going, what are you talking about? And I could not believe that. That was 1972, and I didn't get closure until they had the moving Vietnam wall out here in Lemoore, and I saw his name on there, and I finally got to cry. But, you know, it's like, you know, we were, you know, thick as thieves, you know, and you have your you know, your small group of friends and just what we were. And I saw his name on there. And every time I, you know, go back to Washington, D.C., and I would tell people his name's right there. I don't see it, but it's right there. When I went on honor flight, his name was right there.
Well, I want to come back to the honor flight, but you mentioned a story there. And, you know, and this is what I'm sure you find with unsung heroes. There's always these intense moments. There's the moments of fear. But then there's the anecdotes that put a smile on your face or give you a chuckle years later. And you just told me that one of the famed admirals of the Vietnam era, Elmo Zumwalt, owes you $50.
Yeah.
Give me the story.
Zumwalt was, how do you say, a sailor, okay? He loved being with the enlisted guys. And of course, you know, we played poker and dice and whatever else. How would I say this? I didn't know how to do the money. I always had money, okay? One of the older guys showed me how to do this. He says, take this $100 and I want you to hang on to it. We're going to Hong Kong. He says, I guarantee we're going to be there for 7 days. Everybody's going to be broke in 2 days. What? He says, yeah, you just hang on to this $100. You know, you that slush fund, you can charge whatever you want to get your $20 back. And, you know, you go 20 for 20 or 20 for 30, and guess what? You got your money back during payday. But anyway, we're in between paydays, okay? And we're playing poker, and Zumwalt, he told somebody, he says, I want to see Petty Officer Vance. I'm like, what the hell did I do? He knew I had money, okay? And he says, the guys are going to be playing poker down there, and I just want to borrow $50. What is this? He says, I know you got money. Like, oh, okay. I mean, the guy could have busted me, okay? So I gave it to him. But anyway, we had emergency get out of there in a hurry where we were at. I didn't get to see Zumwalt again. And I'm going like, that guy owes me $50. You know, and he passed away. I never got my money back. Never got my money. You know, that's one of them true stories that, you know, you don't hear about. But Zumwalt was, you know, he's down there from Tulare. You know, just a regular person. You know, so yeah, he's an admiral. He's way up there on the totem pole of, you know, of officers and stuff. But he'd hang out with the enlisted guys. You know, that's just how he was. You know, and people don't know that. They don't know that. No, I know it, okay? You know, we talk about Fresno. You talk about Tulare. And, you know, it's like, hey, we're 40 miles from each other. And we're 8,000 miles away from home, okay? You know, it was good and bad. You know, the enlisted guys would look at me. They'd look at me side-eyed like, you know this guy? You know? It's like, yeah, well, I don't know him personally, but I know where he's from, okay? Right down the road from me from where I'm at in Fresno. Well, I guess you guys are like neighbors, and from compared to from where we are, yes, we were, okay, 40 miles and 8,000 miles.
So when you came home, was it hard for you to get used to living in the States again, living as a civilian again?
When I came home, my wife and kids went to San Jose, and I got on a plane and went to L.A. to see my dad. I couldn't deal with, you know, and I tell you, all my friends became Johnny Joe, Jack, and Jim, and Jose, you know, Bud would bring Christian Brothers along sometime. I did. I became lost, totally lost. I think I was down there for about a week, and my mother finally called, and she says, remember that conversation we had when you were 12 years old? Oh, yes, ma'am. She says, I'll see you in a couple of days. My mother didn't yell at me. She didn't scream at me or nothing. And she says, I'll just see you in a couple of days. I knew what that meant. Get your butt home. She gave me another day to sober myself up. She says, now you write a resume. Well, what's a resume? She said, I want you to tell me all the stuff you did in the military. My mom said, you know, your cousin Vera's in San Jose. She said, really, what's she doing up there? She's a nurse, you know. I said, hey, the Ford Motor Plant's up there. I can go get a job up there, you know. Mom said, sure, you know, take the car. Before I could get out of Fresno, Paul, this is a true story, right? Some guy had robbed a 7-Eleven or something, right? And I'll never forget this. I wrote that down in my memoirs. I was on H and Palm at a car wash over there, washing the car off. I said, okay, I'll go in this little store right there and get me something to drink. Next thing I know, there are six policemen there with their guns drawn on me. I'm like, what? And they said, you just robbed a liquor store. What? Now, you know, make this story so bad? Just got out of the Navy. Guess what? I got a pocket full of money. Been out of the Navy for a week, okay? And I'm going like, no, no, no. You know, one policeman standing over me, he's a white guy, he says, don't move. Got my handcuffs behind my back, I'm face down in the dirt. I never told anybody that story. One of the other guys says, they came on the radio and says, oh, we caught the guy. Them police officers never did apologize to me. And I never told anybody that. And I couldn't get out of here fast enough. When I got to San Jose, I called my mom and dad and I says, you know what? I'll be back in Fresno where I don't need a job.
Well, and now you made a job for yourself trying to tell the stories of these other African-American veterans. And there's something I don't want to leave out either. You have experience not just in the Navy, but you served in a later conflict in Vietnam. You ended up going to the Middle East with the Army?
Yeah. You know, around 1990 or 91, I'd got out of the Navy Reserves and, you know, I was out for 10 years. And, you know, and it's like, oh, you know, the light came. Like, hey, you need to go back and finish that 4 years, you know, to have a good 20. Well, I tried to get back in the Navy, and of course, they said, you're too old. Like, oh, my gosh, now what am I going to do? And the recruiter says, let's go see my Army buddy. I'm like, Army? I don't know about Army. And the recruiter says, he asked me, he says, can you do push-ups? Can you do sit-ups? Can you run? I said, probably not. He says, can you fire a weapon? I said, I couldn't hit Mount Everest if it was 10 feet away. And the guy says, you'll be fine. We'll teach you. You know, I was still pretty good shape. Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, well, this ought to be easy. You know, finished, you know, 4 more years, signed up for 8 years. I was in an Army National Guard. Less than a year, 9/11 happened. I think it was November of 2003. And we finally got the word, you guys are getting shipped out. I'm like, this is not happening. The funny thing about that, the day I got out of the Navy, 30 years before that, I got shipped off to Iraq. The same date. And this is not happening. You know, I'm 50 years old. This is a bad dream. Oh, August 31st, 2004, myself and my battle buddy, Arturo Jones, we had just finished working out. We said, nah, we'll go take a shower later. So we waited till about 1700. Jonesy went in the shower first. He went to the fourth stall and I went to the first stall. This is what Jonesy told me because I was out of it. He told me, he says, he heard me yell. And he heard me flopping around in the shower like a fish out of water. And he came over to see what was going on. And he said I'd stopped breathing by the time he got there. But I was still full of electricity. And he said he got the crap knocked out of him. I don't even see that burn in my finger right there. Mm-hmm. It came out of my back. Jonesy said, he said I died and he was yelling for help. He said it was funny and it wasn't funny. Here's one naked guy pulling another naked guy out of the shower, okay? And the guys finally showed up, and they gave me CPR and took me to the medical center. And the corpsman over there told me, he says, that I was very lucky. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, if I'd have touched that shower with my left hand, I wouldn't have recovered. He said, my heart would have blew up. As it was, it stopped, and they brought me back. But anyway, Arturo Jones Jr., he saved my life, okay? He got the crap knocked out of him, and I can say this. He never got recognized by a company. Never got recognized. And I've been trying to get the congressman to come over here and hand a personal certificate to him.
But he's going to be here at your luncheon?
Oh, yeah, he's going to be here. Uh-huh. He'll bring his family. Yeah. And I told him years and years ago, I said, Jonesy, I'm going to get you recognized. And he goes, like, okay, Sarge. He just left it like that. And the difference between Vietnam and Iraq, Vietnam, it took me 50 years later before I got my parade. When I got to go on honor flight, Washington, D.C. I can say that's one of the greatest things that I had from being in the military. I'll tell you, on the flight back home, when they had mail call, And I don't know how people plan that, but that was really sneaky to get that mail. I mean, you know, I read mail for an hour and a half, and for an hour I was crying. An entire hour, I know I was crying just reading the letters from people. But Iraq was, that was just a waste of time. Soldiers died for nothing. I'm not a politician or a person way up on the totem pole when the president says, go pack your gear and get. Okay, that's the bottom line from being in the military. This is what you get to have. You get to pack your gear. Okay, you say goodbye to your family, and you're out.
The honor flight, you just told us some powerful stuff there with regard to the mail call. I'm curious, though, what it was like to be at the wall with a bunch of other Vietnam vets, to find your high school classmates' name on the wall, and just to be there, to be present there. What did you experience there?
They got bent, being on the wall and seeing the names up there. That's just so sentimental, I don't know. You know, it's... I would see a lot of people cry. I cried. You know, people would get on their hands and knees and they would pray. But just to be that wall, you know, something that's so simple, that's very simple, just to be there with your friend's name and take you back that 50 years and bring back like, oh yeah, we were just kids when we were 15, 16 years old then. And you say like, he's always going to be 19. You'll never get old. You'll never get old. You know, it will always be 19 years old. Like I said, I'm 71 now. You're still 19.
And you said something else, right? You said you had to wait 50 years to get your parade. So you come back to the airport. You've got the bagpiper leading you out. You've got active duty sailors in those same whites you used to wear that are standing in attention saluting you. And then you've got a crowd of 1,000-plus people all in red, white, and blue cheering for you while the band plays. Yeah. That's what it looked like from my vantage point. What did it feel like for you? What did it mean?
When I got back and the bagpipes were playing, that was better than any 20-piece band, you know, just to hear that music. But just to, you know, I got my parade, you know, like so many other veterans, they never got their parade. And I got my parade. And I saw my wife as I was coming out of there, and she's smiling, she's crying. Why is she crying? I'm the one supposed to be crying. And she told me, you know, when my guardian finally let me go and released me in the parking lot, she says, you finally got your parade, huh, babe? I said, yeah, it's all complete now. It's all good. No matter what happens the rest of my life, I got my parade. You know, like so many other Vietnam veterans, it's, you know, they... you know, called all kind of dirty names and stuff like that. I can tell you this, Paul, 99.9% of those Vietnam era veterans, they did not want to go to Vietnam. El Presidente says, pack your grip, you're out. Okay. And the draft says, come on down. You come on down or they'll come and get you. There was no choice.
You know, it just strikes me as you talk about finally getting your parade and sharing with us what that meant to you, that what you're doing with the Unsung Heroes Living History Project and this luncheon that'll be February 25th in Fresno, California. That's a way of giving a parade for some people who might not have ever had theirs either. Is that right?
Exactly what you just said. That's what Unsung Heroes is all about. Lisa Daniels does Unsung Heroes on a national, international note about veterans, you know, Montford Point and Tuskegee Airmen. What I do right here in Fresno, right about my veterans right here in West Fresno, people don't even know who they are or what they did. But, you know, just to get a little bit of notice, a notification of what they did, It shocks a lot of people. One young lady saw a picture of her grandpa up there. And I says, who is your grandpa? And she said, Mr. Foster, Irwin Foster? And she goes, like, yeah. I says, do you know anything about your grandpa? Yeah, he's my grandpa. I says, I want you to look up there at that caption on that picture. And it says, Irwin Foster, Louisiana Army Air Corps. I said, see, your grandpa is part of history. She goes like, what do you mean? He was in the military before there was an Air Force. Is that important? See what I mean? Unsung heroes, okay? A lot of people, they don't know that. You know, just like a lot of the veterans, soldiers who went in the military when they're age 16. They don't know that. You know, you see a 16-year-old kid, right?
I have a 16-year-old daughter at home, yeah.
Exactly. Okay, now, can you see her in the military at 16? You cannot see that, huh?
No way, Jose. But she's tough. She's strong. But, yeah, not thinking that.
You just can't see that. You know, I thought about that. You know, my nieces and nephews, they're in here all the time. Like, how can somebody 16 years old, you know, and even in during the Civil War, they were even younger. You know, that's just totally unheard of. But, you know, that was life back then. And, you know, they don't allow that now. I think there was one kid went into Vietnam when he was 15 years old. You're a big kid. Like, okay, yeah, you know, the drill instructor's like, come on, yeah, we can work you out or whatever, okay? You'll be fine carrying up. I'll make you my mule, you know, carrying that stuff. And, you know, a lot of guys lie about their age and they want to help their families out, you know.
Well, if there's anything else you want to add, feel free, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country in the Navy in the Army later on. And thank you for sharing your story and everything you're doing to preserve the stories of others. Is there anything else you think we ought to know?
Yeah, February 25th from 11 to 3. If you any way possible, come down to the Maxie Park Center, 1802 East California, right on the corner of California and Elm in West Fresno. And it's a luncheon we're going to have over here. And I'd appreciate it if you can come out.
And again, you can find more information on that and the Unsung Heroes Living History Project at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.